Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and we're sponsored once again by ZipRecruiter. Right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. And more from ZipRecruiter later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with the good martini. We'll possibly hear more about it tonight with Trump's address to the joint session of Congress and the nation. But yesterday, Monday, we got some ideas from Budget Director Mick Mulvaney about the Trump idea for what the budget should look like for the coming fiscal year. Most of it is not a surprise. He wants to beef up military spending. He wants to beef up border security. And to pay for that, without touching entitlements, he's going to go after some domestic portions of the budget, including a nearly 25% gash in the EPA budget, which I know a lot of conservatives will say is about 75% too small. But here's Mick Mulvaney on Good Morning America with George Stephanopoulos this morning.
He's kept his promises without adding to this year's deficit. It would have been very easy for the president to come in and say, let's spend more money and let's blow up the deficit. But what you're seeing here is a very powerful message to your earlier point. What the president wants is to move spending from, say, overseas back in this country. That's why you'll see fairly significant reductions in his proposals regarding foreign aid. But he's doing all of this without adding to this year's deficit. And I think that is a very powerful message from the president of the United States to Congress.
And so Stephanopoulos and a lot of the Democrats on the Hill, Jim, are talking about how this will take a wrecking ball to the economy and to health care and to vital programs that Americans need. And how he's going to do all this without touching entitlements is basically a big sleight of hand. Obviously, big decisions still need to be made. The blueprint is the wish list. It's not the final deal. But in terms of spending priorities, conservatives, for the most part, ought to be pretty pleased here, it seems like.
Indeed, Greg. We were pretty pleased to see Mick Mulvaney at OMB. Donald Trump, a member on the campaign trail, really didn't spend a lot of time talking about reducing government spending, spent a lot of time talking about how much he was going to protect entitlement spending, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And so those of us who think of ourselves as fiscal hawks or small government conservatives had good reason to worry how committed Trump was to this. Well, his rhetoric hasn't changed, but his personnel is pointing in the right direction. And this initial budget proposal, or maybe not even a proposal, which is just kind of say broad outlines, is pointing in the right direction. I think it's safe to look at this as a opening bid in the classic Trump negotiating style. I don't know if he's going to get the full 54% increase in defense spending, but it's a nice way to start negotiations so that any increase would still be a pretty significant improvement upon the baseline. I don't know if he's going to get the deep cuts in the EPA and various other agencies that he's looking for. Nonetheless, the fact once you start at 25%, if you end up cutting 10%, 15%, that's still a major significant victory and going to require some prioritization over there. All in all, this is pretty good. Now, the editors at National Review point out that really when you look at the overall budget proposal, the debt is still a pretty significant problem, particularly if you go through with the defense spending increases that he's looking for. Keeping entitlement reform off the table is not really a long-term option. Some of us would argue it's not even really a short-term option. Mm-hmm. But all in all, there's a lot more fiscal conservatism and focus on spending reductions in this Trump administration than we had any right to expect about 6 months ago. So that's what we're going to say, our cautiously optimistic good martini of the day. And obviously, look, the budgeting process is long and complicated and heavily influenced by Congress. But all in all, this is a nice start for the Trump administration when it comes to trying to reduce spending and places where it isn't nearly as needed as some other areas.
Jim, as you know, the first 100 days and really the first year of a presidential administration is the golden window of opportunity to get a lot done. So if the president is putting off entitlements for now, and that's an area, of course, that Paul Ryan says we have to deal with. Dave Bratt, the guy that knocked off Eric Cantor a couple of years ago, says that's got to be part of any long-term effect here when you're dealing with Obamacare reform or anything else that has to be dealt with given the insolvency schedule that we're on right now. If we're punting now, is that an indication that we have no intention of dealing with this in this Congress and perhaps this first term?
Yeah, I think over time I'm reaching the point where these sorts of things are only going to be dealt with when they reach the point of crisis. There was a fairly clear choice before the American people back in 2012 Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan had really focused upon this and kind of the idea of you know, serious entitlement reform as a key part of both of their careers in government. Barack Obama talked about what a big priority it was, but didn't actually do anything in his first term and obviously didn't do anything in his second term. We keep putting this option in front of the American people, and the American people keep saying, nah, no, I'm sure it's fine. It'll take care of itself. Don't worry about it. We are not great long-term thinkers in this country, particularly when it comes to sacrificing today for a better outcome tomorrow. At some point, I could be expressed disappointment in Republicans on this, but on the other hand, it's kind of hard to blame them. How many times are you going to try to drag the country kicking and screaming to a more secure financial footing if it really doesn't want to go in that direction? Republicans have learned from the Democrats on this. And so my fear is that we'll not only deal at this point when it becomes a crisis, which, considering the retirement rate of the baby boomers, isn't that far away. Trump's learned very carefully from the lessons of Democrats. And that's, when people start talking about the need to reform entitlements, say, no, you won't. No, we don't need to do it. Everything's fine. And we'll deal with it later.
Well, he was certainly consistent about that during the campaign. And you're right that Romney and Ryan tried to make that a key point. I don't know if that cost him the election in 2012, but it certainly didn't put him over the top. And right after George W. Bush got elected in 2005, he tried to take on Social Security reform, and virtually no one was interested in that, even in his own party. So good point there about the people just not wanting it, and perhaps they'll think better of it when we get to a crisis moment. But Jim, speaking of former President George W. Bush, let's go to our bad martini. He was a guest on Monday on the Today Show with Matt Lauer. And even though Matt Lauer's been there forever now, every time I think of him when we do a clip of him, I think of the day that they hired him and Tom Brokaw just kicking the trash can, because of all the names that it's got to be difficult for Tom Brokaw to say, Lauer has got to be pretty close to the top of the list. So, but anyway, they were talking about a number of things. President Bush has a new book out. He painted the faces of a lot of wounded warriors, and it's a book called Portraits of Courage, and he tells their stories in addition to showing the paintings. But, of course, politics came in. He talked about how he wasn't thrilled with the way the Trump administration was handling the press. And then they got to the issue of the president's executive order. Bush doing a pretty good tap dance on not saying whether he would support or oppose the order. But listen to Lauer here. Lauer had just read a quote from Bush shortly after the 9/11 attacks about how there are many things to admire in Islam and there should be no backlash towards Muslims and that sort of thing. Here's how Lauer led into this with Bush's response as well.
Just after those attacks, you gave a speech and you said this: I also want to speak tonight directly to Muslims throughout the world. We respect your faith. It's practiced freely by many millions of Americans and by millions more in countries that America counts as friends. Its teachings are good and peaceful. That's very different talk than what we're hearing today about a Muslim ban. Do you think the president's position on this has been well thought out?
I think it's very important for all of us to recognize one of our great strengths is for people to be able to worship the way they want to or not worship at all. I mean, the bedrock of our freedom, a bedrock of our freedom, is the right to worship freely. And I understood right off the bat, Matt, that this was an ideological conflict. And people who murder the innocent are not religious people. They want to advance an ideology. And we have faced those kind of ideologues in the past.
Jim, a couple things to be disappointed with here. First of all, Lauer calling it a Muslim ban and clearly leading Bush to try and agree with him that it was a bad idea. And then Bush going down the road that anybody who kills in the name of Islam is automatically disqualified from being called that. So, and I think the third thing here is that Bush is willing to criticize now when he wasn't for the past 8 years.
Yeah, it's no true Scotsman fallacy. Made rather explicit in that, because you'd really like to put to the former president with great respect, where exactly do you draw the line between an ideology and a religion? We may point to them and insist, oh, no, it's not really a religion. It's a perversion of Islam. It's just an ideology. But they call themselves literally the Islamic State. I think there's a pretty fundamental difference on whether it speaks for the religion. And I think one of our great frustrations since 9/11 has been the Muslim world's less than clear assertion that their interpretation of the faith is a false one and does not fit in their philosophy. Backtracking a little bit, look, you know, God bless George W. Bush. He's always going to be one of my favorite presidents, and I love this book of portraits of wounded soldiers that he's doing. I think he's a good, big-hearted guy. But he decided, you know, during the Obama administration that he was going to keep his mouth shut, that he owed it to the president who came after him to not be critical, to not hector from the sidelines, that there was kind of this unspoken rule that presidents didn't criticize their successors. I say an unspoken rule because I don't know if Bill Clinton ever got that memo. I know Jimmy Carter never got that memo. And it really feels like a one-way street, the idea that Republican presidents try not to criticize their Democratic successors, but the favor is not returned. And to see Bush coming out here, and look, this is a very mild criticism of the Trump administration. Deep down, you have a feeling that George W. Bush, off the record, might have much stronger criticisms of Donald Trump. But he's trying to couch it in his subdued a tone as possible. But coming after, you know, pretty much 8 years of pretty solid, if not silence, the near silence from George W. Bush, you can completely understand why Trump fans be kind of grinding their teeth over this, of Bush emerging and sounding like he, too, is critical of President Trump. And people are going to, you know, attribute this to stuff like Jeb Bush's presidential campaign and the diminishing role of the Bush family in Republican Party politics and things like that. All in all, I would rather not see George W. Bush come, you know, speaking out as a vocal critic of Trump, unless I guess he really feels like it's something he absolutely can't keep, you know, his mouth quiet about. I would just note that he's managed to keep his mouth quiet for almost the entirety of the Obama administration, and I'm sure Obama was doing a lot of things that he didn't agree with. So it's just gonna further divide the party, and I'd like to see President Bush stepping out into a role that's uncomfortable. I remember somebody saying back to you shortly after Election Day, he really hoped that Trump and George W. Bush could at least reach a point where they could talk to each other, because Trump was going to need somebody who's been there, who understands the office, who understands the responsibilities of power, just to be a sounding board, just to be somebody who knows exactly what he's going through in the darkest hours of his presidency. And I just don't know if Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or Jimmy Carter are really the better options for him.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. He really just needs somebody who at least understands in some part where he's coming from ideologically, even though there are significant differences between the two. So very interesting on that front. Jim, let's move on to the latest news from ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you've got to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can, because with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Jim, that seems a lot more efficient than handing out business cards at CPAC.
No, I was just to say, I was there last week. I saw everybody exchanging business cards. They had people who were doing free career counseling. There were people who were doing jobs fairs and people who were obviously, it's a big kind of talent recruitment. It's almost the NFL combine for conservative political activists. You know, people running sprints and how quickly can you knock on doors, things like that. Look, I was just kind of curious how many employers there were on ZipRecruiter. If they're not, they really ought to be, considering the efficiency of it, the ability to cast that wide a net, and in all likelihood, find exactly the kind of candidates you're looking for.
Everybody's got a good story when they're standing there face to face in their really nice suit and tie or whatever, and everything they did at college was the best, and no one's done it better. So, and that probably was.
I'm sure you've had some of those conversations, huh, Greg?
I love interns, really, I do. But that's kind of who's at CPAC, and that's who's the future of the conservative movement. But if you're going to get these people, you really need to get the best, and ZipRecruiter is the best way to really sift through them. There's probably a lot of excellent candidates that walked through those halls last week, but some are better fits for certain jobs than others, and ZipRecruiter would be great for that. So find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen your candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. So basically, every size company benefits by using ZipRecruiter. And right now, 3 Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time. if you got the pen in hand finally, ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. On to our crazy martini now, Jim. And Ala Pundit over at Hot Air thinks this story came really from the West Wing years ago. And so this is an Aaron Sorkin plot, not necessarily the original idea of New Mexico Senator Tom Udall. He has decided that the best way to bridge the divide between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate over what happened to Merrick Garland and what's about to happen to Neil Gorsuch. Hey, let's just confirm them both. Here's what Udall says. You had President Trump saying, I want to unite the country. I'm a deal maker. I'm going to bring people together, Udall told reporters following his meeting with Gorsuch on Monday. Well, the deal right now for President Trump, if he wanted to do it, would be to put Gorsuch and Merrick Garland on the court at the same time. This is how Udall described it. Trump would discuss the option with one of the three Supreme Court justices often mentioned as retirement prospects in the coming years, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, or Anthony Kennedy, and secure a resignation letter from one of them, contingent on Garland getting nominated and confirmed as their replacement. Then the two nominees would have a simultaneous confirmation process and vote. Jim, this is kind of cute. It's kind of unconstitutional, and it's kind of pathetic that the Democrats are still trying to beat this drum when that chance ended weeks ago now.
I'm sitting here scratching my head, Greg, trying to figure out, under Udall's plan, what's the upside for Trump?
Nothing.
Right? I mean, like, what does he get? Because I guess the argument would be, well, on paper, if you call up Ruth Bader Ginsburg and say, Ruth, how you feeling? She says, not so good, and she decides to step down. Then you're replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg with Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland is, you know, considered a slightly less to the left judge than Ginsburg has been on the bench so far. So you're getting a moderate Democrat. I mean, you know, these aren't really perfect terms, but you get my gist. And you're getting Judge Gorsuch as well, replacing Scalia and Ginsburg. But here's the thing. If you're Donald Trump, you can replace Scalia with Gorsuch. And then when Ginsburg retires, you can find some other conservative judge. And if you have to nuke the filibuster, you can nuke the filibuster. But you get two judges you want instead of one judge you want and one you don't want. So I get what Tom Udall gets out of it. I get what Democrats get out of it. I get what Ruth Bader Ginsburg gets out of it. I don't get what Trump and conservatives and Republicans really get out of it. Unless the idea is, then this way lots of Democrats would vote for Judge Neil Gorsuch. But I don't know, can Tom Udall make that kind of promise on behalf of all Senate Democrats? Are you really sure they'd get on board with that? I'm rather skeptical that they'd all go along.
It's just amazing how Republicans are expected to make certain concessions in moments like these, and Democrats never are. Bill Clinton replaced Whizzer White, who was appointed by a Democrat but was eventually a fairly conservative justice, with Ginsburg. And Republicans, I'm sure, weren't thrilled with that. But Ginsburg got confirmed, I think, about 96-3. And then when Sandra Day O'Connor decided to retire, I remember Chuck Schumer, with the glasses down at the end of the nose, of course, insisting that it had to be a moderate because the balance of the court was at stake, and to appoint a conservative would have really thrown things off. So for thee, but not for me, is the way the Democrats seem to approach these things.
Yeah, it's worth noting both Scalia and Ginsburg were confirmed with 90-some votes. The philosophy in the Senate used to be that if the judge had no scandals in his past, had a distinguished enough record, was widely enough respected by his peers and colleagues and everyone who'd ever dealt with him, well then, they got to go up on the court regardless of whether they were likely to govern as a strict constructionist or as a emanating penumbra-loving alternative. That basically, if the president wanted him, the choice was qualified fine. This broke down, some might argue, around Clarence Thomas. Some might say this, go back further back and say the Bork nomination. But somewhere along the line, it became very clear that certain, particularly I believe with Roberts and Alito, it was very clear that most Democrats were not only not willing to vote for a candidate or willing to vote for a nominee they didn't like, they were willing to try to filibuster for someone they didn't like, including President Obama, who was then a senator and who then later, once he was president, was nominating people to the Supreme Court. He said filibusters were the worst thing ever. Now that he was making the nomination. So Republicans just aren't going to fall for that any longer. Now, if Democrats, I suppose, here's the thing. Let me give an alternative proposal to Tom Udall. Lots of Democrats vote to confirm Judge Gorsuch because deep down you're not really losing anything, right? You're just replacing Antonin Scalia with someone who's like him in philosophy and is likely to vote the same way. Then when one of the liberal justices, for lack of a better term, or when Kennedy, you know, picked, remember that list of 22 justices that Trump had submitted during the campaign? He picks the most leftward person out of that group of 22 rightward justices. A lot of people are going to say this is like being the tallest midget. That basically there are no liberal choices. You only have conservative, more conservative, super-duper conservative, and extremely conservative. But, you know, we're going to find one on that list of 22, the one that offends you the least, Senate Democrats, and that's how we'll work it out, and that's how things will turn out. There's my counteroffer, Tom Udall. What do you think? Because I'm sure he's listening. Let's see what he thinks of this idea.
Yeah, he might not be enamored with that. two closing notes. You probably noticed that Jim is on the phone today. He's up in New York to do CNN International. So that, as Trump would say, there will be at least one segment today that is not fake news. And Jim, I don't know if you're playing a drinking game tonight with Trump's speech to the joint session. If anybody really wants to get plowed, what are the catchphrases you're looking for?
Oh, obviously, huge is always a great one. I actually think I'm less intrigued by what Trump says tonight than by how Democrats in the chamber respond. We all remember Joe Wilson rather infamously shouting, "You lie," during a point in Obama's speech about Obamacare a couple of years ago. Ironically, when you say Obamacare, Obama insisted that the Affordable Care Act would not cover illegal immigrants. Lo and behold, later on, did. But Joe Wilson said he really regretted it. It was a breach of decorum. There was this argument that he deserved to be censured by the House and all that kind of stuff. Considering the fury of the Democratic base, Greg, I suspect that not only will Democratic members start yelling, I at some point I almost wonder if someone will like rush the podium or something like that. There's going to be such competition to have the most flamboyant opposition to Trump. They may walk out. They may boo. They may shout. That my guess is that we'll see, you know, a pretty significant breakdown in the traditional decorum of presidential addresses, because there is so much incentive for a Democratic lawmaker. Because once you do that, you're a star. You're not just one of those 200-some members of the Democratic House, another face in the crowd. You become a star, the one person who's willing to stand up to Trump, et cetera. So my guess is you'll actually see several interruptions tonight. And that will be the big story coming out of the night is, you know, the heroic Democrats who weren't going to let a little thing like decorum stand in the way of letting the world know how much they oppose Trump, because nobody could have possibly known that a Democratic member of Congress would oppose Trump. Right, Greg?
The media will love them. Middle America will support the president. And that's how we got here in the first place. So, Jim, have a great day. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. Remember to visit our friends at ZipRecruiter.com. Right now, 3 Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. Tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.